Chapter 22. Sheriff Goodman hunched deeper into his coat against the cold and turned a full circle in the convenience store's back lot. He said, "I assume they parked here. Therefore, they probably changed here, too. Maybe they trash your old jackets. The knife, too, possibly. We should check the trash cans." Sorensen said,
"You volunteering?"
"I have deputies with nothing better to do."
"Okay," Sorensen said. "But it's probably a waste of time. A buck gets 10, they pitch the jackets in Del Fuenzo's trunk. And they probably drop the knife down one of the water pipes in the bunker."
"Are you going to try a third roadblock?"
"Iowa doesn't have the manpower."
"Illinois, then. If they're staying on the interstate, they're most likely going all the way to Chicago. You could have the Illinois cops waiting for them right on the state line."
"They have to know they're pushing their luck. They've survived twice. They won't risk a third time. They're going to take back roads now. Or go to ground somewhere."
"So we're done with the roadblocks?"
"I think there's nothing more to be gained."
"Will their thinking match yours?"
"I'm trying to make mine match theirs."
"Then that's bad news for Karen Del Fuenzo," Goodman said. "They don't need the smokescreen anymore. They'll dump her out in the middle of nowhere."
"They won't,"
Sorensen said.
"She's seen their faces. They'll kill her."
The first question in Reacher's mind was, would they call out roadblocks in two separate states for a carjacking? And the answer was yes, probably. Almost certainly, in fact. Because carjacking where the owner was forced to stay on board was kidnapping, and kidnapping was a big, big deal. A federal case, literally, handled by the FBI, which was the only agency capable of coordinating a multi-state response. And the local terrain was huge and empty. Blocking the roads was about the only option for any kind of law enforcement in that part of the country. That, and helicopters. And Reacher had seen a helicopter 1,000 feet up with a searchlight. Second question. What were the odds against two sets of roadblock-worthy and helicopter-worthy and FBI-worthy fugitives being on the loose on the same winter night in the same lonely place? Answer: very long odds indeed. Very unlikely. Coincidences happened, but to be there to witness one was a coincidence in itself, and two simultaneous coincidences was one too many. Therefore, the roadblocks had been for King and McQueen. Two guys, not one. Almost certainly. Which made no sense initially. Because the first roadblock in Nebraska had been looking hard at lone drivers. Which was explicable in a way. Obviously, a lone guy could disguise himself by picking up a second guy, and two guys could disguise themselves by picking up a third guy, and so on forever. An addition method. But subtraction could work too, as in two guys could disguise themselves by one of them hiding out of sight. And the Nebraska cops had been smart enough to anticipate that maneuver. Lone drivers had had their trunks searched, not for drugs or guns or bombs or stolen goods, but for a second guy curled up and hiding. But the Nebraska cops shouldn't have been looking for two people. They should have been looking for three people. The two perpetrators plus the carjack victim, a more or less topless roadhouse bartender. Which introduced an incongruity. As in, King and McQueen clearly believed the APB would be for those three people, themselves and Del Fuenzo, because they had given Del Fuenzo a shirt to alter her appearance, the disguise method. And then they had gone the extra mile. They had given a hitchhiker a ride, Reacher himself, a fourth person. The addition method. Four people, not three. A smokescreen, a deception, starting with the bland shirts and continuing even to the extent of getting Reacher himself into the driver's seat for the second roadblock. A smokescreen, a deception, and more than anything else, a diversion. The busted nose. Any cop would have been distracted by it. And there had been no democratic discussion at the Cloverleaf right back at the beginning. That particular conversation had been of a different kind entirely. King and McQueen had twisted around in their seats and told Del Fuenzo they would hurt her bad if she betrayed them. They had spelled it out, Keep your mouth shut. Then they had pressed her. Are we clear on that? Do you understand? Reacher had seen her nod, say yes, quiet and scared and timid, just before he got in the car. And the aspirin episode had not been about concern for a stranger's health. By that point, Alan King had already decided he wanted Reacher driving later. And he had not monitored Del Fuenzo's search through her bag out of innocent eagerness or excitement. He had been making sure she didn't find some way of signaling for help. Reality. Reacher was no one's first choice of nighttime companion. King and McQueen had offered the ride for one reason only. They were defending themselves against a 3-person APB. But the actual APB had been for 2 people. Why? Only one possible answer. The FBI had known there were 2 guys on the run, but they hadn't known the 2 guys had jacked a car and taken a hostage. In which case, did the FBI know now? And therefore, the roadblocks had not been for the carjacking. Not in and of itself. Not if the FBI didn't even know about the carjacking. The roadblocks had been for the primary crime, which must therefore have been pretty bad. Blood on their clothes. Reacher drove on, 80 miles an hour through the Iowa darkness, breathing slow and steady. Goodman and Sorensen walked back to the red Mazda. Sorensen's FBI crime scene team had moved up from the pumping station and were all over it. They had already found blood and fingerprints and hairs and fibers. The 2 men had taken no forensic precautions. That was clear. Sorensen said,
"They were very disorganized."
Goodman said, "Most criminals are."
"But these guys are not like most criminals in any other way. This was not a mugging or a robbery gone wrong. They wore suits. The State Department is involved. But they were completely unprepared. They didn't plan. They're improvising all the way. They even had to hijack their getaway vehicle, for God's sake. Why?"
"Maybe they didn't plan because they didn't know they needed to plan."
"You come all the way to Nebraska to kill a guy, you know you need to plan."
"Maybe they didn't come to kill a guy. Or not yet, anyway. Maybe something got out of hand all of a sudden. Most homicides are spontaneous."
"I agree," Sorensen said. "But nothing else about this case feels spontaneous."
Goodman sent a deputy to check the dumpsters behind the convenience store. Then the head crime scene technician backed butt first out of the Mazda and walked over to Sorensen with 2 photographs in his hand. The first was a color Polaroid of the dead guy's face, cleaned up, eyes opened, blood wiped away, arranged to look as close to a live guy as a dead guy can get. He had dark eyes, shaped like almonds, tipped up a little at the outside corners. He had a small circular mole low down on his right cheek, south and west of his mouth. On a woman, it would have been called a beauty spot. On a man, it just looked like a mole. The second photograph was a monochrome blow-up of the same face, from a video still. From a surveillance camera, almost certainly. It was of poor quality, very grainy, smeared a little by movement and a cheap CCD camera and fluorescent light and a low-bit digital recording. But the eyes were clearly recognizable. And the mole was there, in the same place, perfectly positioned, as unique as a barcode or a fingerprint, and as definitive as a DNA sample.
"From where?"
Sorensen asked. "The rental counter at the Denver airport," the technician said. "The victim rented the Mazda himself just after 9 o'clock this morning. Now, yesterday morning, technically. The mileage on the car indicates he drove straight here with no significant detours."
"That's a long way."
"Little over 700 miles. 10 or 11 hours, probably. 1 stop for gas. The tank is low now."
"Did he drive all that way alone?"
"I don't know," the technician said. "I wasn't there." A cautious guy, old school, data-driven, and possibly a little bad-tempered. Night duty in the winter in the middle of nowhere. Sorensen asked,
"What's your best guess?"
"I'm a scientist," the guy said. "I don't guess."
"Then speculate."
The guy made a face. "There's no trace evidence in the back of the car," he said, "but both front seats show signs of occupation. So he might have had a single passenger from Denver. Or he might have driven in alone, in which case the passenger seat trace would come from the two perpetrators using the car to get from the crime scene to this location."
"Yes or no?"
"I would say he probably drove in alone. There's more trace on the driver's seat than the passenger seat."
"Like the difference between a 700-mile drive and a 3-mile drive?"
"I can't specify a ratio. It doesn't happen that way. Most trace gets rubbed in over the first minute or two."
"Yes or no? Real world?"
"Probably yes. The driver's seat shows heavy use, the passenger's seat doesn't."
"So how did the two guys get here, wearing suits and no winter coats?"
"Ma'am, I have no idea," the technician said, and walked back to the car. "I have no idea either," Goodman said. "My guys have seen no abandoned cars. That was one of the things I told them to look for."
Sorensen said,
"Obviously they didn't abandon a car. If they had their own car, they wouldn't have had to hijack a cocktail waitress. And we need to know where the fourth guy came from, too. And we need to figure out where he was while his pals were busy in the bunker."
"He sounds distinctive." Sorensen nodded.
"A gorilla with its face smashed in? Anyone should remember a guy like that."
Then her phone rang and she answered it, and Goodman saw her back go straight and her face change. She listened for 30 seconds, and she said, "Okay," and then she said it again, and then she said,
"No, I'll make sure it happens."
And then she clicked off. A straight back, but she had said, "Okay," not, "Yes, sir." Not a superior from her FBI field office, therefore, or from D.C. Goodman asked, "Who was that?"
Sorensen said,
"That was a duty officer in a room in Langley, Virginia."
"Langley?" Sorensen nodded. She said,
"Now the CIA has got its nose in this thing, too. I'm supposed to provide progress reports all through the night,